How are you doing, brothers? It's good to see you both.
Yeah, you too. So how was Europe?
Oh, dude.
I expected you to be on here with like a beret and stuff.
That would have been great. And a mustache.
And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
Stop it!
What's in the box?
Disenfranchised by the modern comics industry, producer Paul Spataro, Dr. Bill Robinson, and Scott H. Gardner now
ply the time stream in a never-ending quest to rediscover and reconnect with that unique brand of fun and excitement that can only truly be found in good old-fashioned, randomly selected comic book back issues. Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
I got nowhere else to go! I got nowhere else to go! I got nothing else.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. Tonight, we are doing our traditional... what you call it? Random comics, as opposed to some sort of theme show that we've been doing so much of lately. And I'm Paul Spataro, and I am here with my random friends, Mr. David Pescarella.
How's it going?
It's going good. How you doing? Why are you stealing the other guy's line?
Because it just fits, and it's now I don't have to think of anything.
Okay.
I never said that until I heard Scott say it, and I wanted it.
It's yours now.
Oh.
We're here with the other guy, Scott H. Gardner.
Oh, I was kind of hoping you'd introduce me as Arnold Palmer, but that's okay.
I'm lost on that.
We could see him.
I'm lost on that.
That's okay.
Let's just say it's huge.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. I don't need to know anymore.
Some people will get it, some people won't.
It's funny when I say the other guy, it reminds me of the stolen costume episode of The Adventures of Superman, which is this is where he hangs it when he's being the other guy. And just for that, I'm going to take the two of you up to a mountain resort and leave you there.
I'll bring you food, just don't try and get down.
So we did plan to do a random episode today, which is how I entered the show. But random turned into a theme, sort of, because Dave picked a G.I. Joe book, which made a little light bulb go off over my head. And then when I managed to turn that off, I said, how about we all do toy comics? So that is our theme for today. But since Dave brought us into the theme by picking his book first, I think it's probably wise for him to read his tome of a synopsis that I'm seeing in front of him before we get to the other books.
This isn't going to be as good as the Doyby Dickles one, but I think that's a bar that we'll never reach death. Okay, I'm bringing to the table G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number 16, cover dated 1983, the month of October, on sale July 12th of 83 for a whopping 60 cents, written by Larry Hama, penciler Mike Vosburgh, inker John D'Agostino, and the title of this issue is Night Attack. On the opening splash page, we see the Joes rolling into battle with guns blazing. The Mobat tank is flanked by the Ram motorcycle and the Vamp Jeep as the Dragonfly helicopter provides air support. I had all of these toys as a child. A flip of the page reveals that this is only a training exercise, like a shooting gallery. Hawk and Breaker pop up more two-dimensional targets of his tanks and pillboxes for the attacking Joes to blast away. Then to test their mettle, a fleet of 10 radio-controlled HIS tanks are released on the Joes. But to keep it fair, Hawk sends in the latest product in the form of the Wolverine, an armored tank-like vehicle that is armed with 12 missiles instead of a main gun. One by one, the HIS tanks are destroyed. When the smoke clears, we're introduced to the new Joe, Cover Girl, who is included with the purchase of the Wolverine. Scarlet and Cover Girl have the mandatory verbal catfight as Clutch leers in the background. Rock and Roll realizes that Cover Girl only fired 8 missiles, but destroyed 10 tanks. Through the smoke emerges another new addition to the team. Sold separately, Tripwire, the new explosives ordnance expert, who destroyed 2 tanks with a magnetic charge. Of course, Tripwire is revealed to be a klutz, tripping over his own mind detector. Elsewhere, in an ARBCO 18-wheeler, Cobra Commander hosts a dinner of the Cobra Elite, including Scarface, who they never made a figure of, Destro, Dr. Venom, and also a character who never got a figure, and the Baroness. The commander introduces the newest member of Cobra, Major Blood. Major Blood praises the commander with poetry. Raise your glasses and sing the praises of our leader, who nothing phases. Cobra Commander, he's my chum. I trust him like I trust my gun.
Ugh.
A real ass kisser. Each guest thinks about their own agenda. Cobra Commander plans to have Blood kill Destro. Blood would rather kill Scarface. Scarface thinks about siding with Destro. Destro doesn't know if the Baroness will side with him or Cobra Commander. Dr. Venom has plans of his own. And the Baroness plans to use all those plots to her own advantage. Ironically, Cobra Commander proposes a toast to victory through unity. In the G.I. Joe headquarters, Hawk tells General Flagg that the ink previously found in Vermont is the same that the Treasury uses to print money, and he believes that Cobra intends to poison America's money supply at the source, the Bureau of Printing and Engraving. Flagg dismisses Hawk's request to throw a cordon around the Treasury building because Cobra has threatened to blow up the Capitol. As the Cobras mingle, Dr. Venom reminds Cobra Commander that he hasn't forgotten the commander's betrayal of him back in issue 12 by ordering the bunker he was in to be bombed. The commander dismisses it and tells Venom that he should let his intellect reign and not hold it against him that the commander took steps most advantageous to him. As they watch the sunset, the commander comments how the sun is setting forever on the stability of the American dollar. In rainy Washington, troops in armor from across the country surround the Capitol building. Hawk tries again to lobby General Flagg to spare some support for the Joes at the Treasury. As Flagg declines, citing that the Joes are supposed to be capable of operating for protracted periods without support, Cobra aircraft blanket the skies over the Capitol building. At the same time, ARBCO trucks arrive at the Treasury building. Dr. Venom, accompanied by Scarface and 2 troopers, break into the Treasury, blasting 2 security officers. Gung-Ho, Torpedo, and Tripwire are waiting for them. Dr. Venom decides to explode the toxin over the presses, and to ensure the Cobra troopers don't retrieve the toxin, Venom kills them and knocks out Scarface. At the Capitol, the Cobra planes are revealed to be radio-controlled scale models, and Hawk realizes that the real target is the Treasury and rushes there with Clutch and Scarlet in the van. Dr. Venom bursts from the Treasury, revealing it's a trap. The commander deploys his tanks, hidden in 18-wheelers. Destro serves as gunner for the commander, and Blood serves as gunner for the Baroness. Through the wall of the Treasury they go with ease. Talk about being built by the lowest bidder. The Joes inside the Treasury are captured, and the toxin is retrieved. As the Cobras march out their prisoners, like an alien chest buster, Covergirl and her Wolverine burst out of a disguised garbage truck, freeing the Joes, and the firefight begins. The commander decides now is the time to eliminate Destro and orders Major Blood to terminate him. The Baroness realizes what's happening and swerves her hiss, crashing it. Blood escapes, but the Baroness, with a broken leg, is trapped in the hiss as it explodes. The commander smashes the Wolverine in making his escape, but stops to pick up Dr. Venom. Venom takes the wheel, and the commander mans the gun as Destro, stricken with grief, stares at the burning wreck containing the Baroness. In pursuit, Hawk jumps from the vamp to the hiss and begins to beat the commander. Destro pulls himself together and engages Hawk. Cobra Commander has a clear shot of both men and finally decides that Hawk is the one who needs imminent killing. Three bullets slam into Hawk, and his body thuds to the street. Clutch and Scarlet race to render aid, but it doesn't look good. Meanwhile, Scarface, disguised in a trench coat, boards a bus and vows vengeance on Dr. Venom. That's my synopsis.
I enjoyed your synopsis more than I actually enjoyed reading this book, and it's not really the fault of the book. Or at least I don't think it is. We've done a few G.I. Joe issues over the years that that I've been on for. And for whatever reason, this series kind of just leaves me out in the cold a little bit. I never feel like I'm with the story. And I felt the same way here. It's kind of like I'm on the outside looking in. I don't feel involved in it. I don't know if it's the writing, because people love this series. So I'm thinking it's more me, just that I've never invested myself in it. So it always just feels kind of run-of-the-mill to me. And I think, again, I think that may be more of a reflection on me than it is on the series. It all seemed okay, but there was nothing about it that really jumped out at me, at any point where I thought, oh, yeah, I love this. That never happened. I don't know if you guys feel significantly different about it than that.
No, I want to agree with you on that, but it puts me in a weird spot, because this is a series that I hear often compared with Marvel Star Wars. They were almost contemporaries. I mean, to a degree, I think Star Wars did, publishing wise, overlap with this a little bit, but Star Wars was kind of winding down as this was getting started. But I know that they both had some of the same fans, but also there's a lot of fans that maybe weren't into Star Wars, but they were into this. So I'm a huge Marvel Star Wars fan. That was kind of my gateway drug into comics. And I have lost the ability to tell, especially with like the early stuff of Marvel Star Wars, like, is it really great, or is it just because that's my childhood and I really love it and I can't look at it objectively? So I'm loath to slag this in any way just because I didn't get into it, because I know that there's people out there that absolutely love this, and this is their childhood, and they see it a particular way that I'm just not able to. I didn't hate it or anything, but I feel much the same way that you just said, Paul, where I kind of read it and I'm like, it's okay, but it doesn't grab me. The only critique I would give in that regard, that maybe it's the material and not just my lack of investment, is that I have recently read some of the IDW stuff with Joe, G.I. Joe, that crossed. So I was going to talk about this more with Paul's book, but I'll get into it a little bit here. So IDW, I don't think they're still doing it, but a few years ago, they got a hold of a number of the toy properties that were beloved Marvel properties back in the 80s, notably G.I. Joe, ROM Space Knight, and the Micronauts, and also Transformers. And they put them all in the same shared universe and did a couple different, like, huge crossover events. And I read ROM, and I am still reading ROM, the IDW ROM, from start to finish. Also Micronauts, which didn't last very long, unfortunately. And then just kind of, quote-unquote, suffering through the Transformers and the G.I. Joe stuff as they cross over and come in and out of the story. And strangely, even though I'm completely friggin' lost and completely ignorant of Transformers, and I don't know much about G.I. Joe, I have found that I really enjoy it because it was written very well, and it wasn't written in a style that I felt excluded. I felt like, to a certain degree, they did kind of hold my hand so that if you were somebody that didn't really know much about it, you were able to glean enough and you weren't completely lost. With this here, the only way that I'm not just completely lost with this is that I did have like the first, I think, dozen issues of G.I. Joe as they came out as a kid. I had them, I read them, I stopped. I'm pretty sure it was just the first dozen, like the first year. I stopped collecting it. I sold them to Chris Honeywell's cousin, and I never really went beyond that. But just that familiarity with the first year gave me enough that I kind of remember like what the deal was and who the major characters were to a certain degree. To me, it was just kind of like, it's there. It didn't necessarily suck me in, but it didn't put me off either. It was just kind of like, okay, this is meant for somebody, not me. I didn't think it was really good or bad. It just wasn't really my thing.
I think I pretty much agree with you. I'm sorry, Dave. I'm going to give you a minute. Just let me get these thoughts out before I forget them. Probably a year or two back, I had John Wilson on, and he brought one of the IDW Transformer issues on with him. And if I remember correctly, I thought it did a good job of kind of involving you in the story, even if you were not familiar with the characters, while still giving the loyal Transformers fans enough to go with. And I thought that was a really good combination. Here, I feel like if you were invested in this and if you know these characters, this story probably has a lot more depth and meaning to it than for somebody with our background with it. I think Larry Hama, from everything I hear, Larry Hama was a great writer on this series. So I'm more or less thinking he wasn't going to spoon feed you. If you wanted to get into this, go get the first 15 issues, start it from the beginning, and then when you read this one, you're going to enjoy it more. That's definitely the feeling I got. Dave, you are the G.I. Joe fan among us, so tell us why we're right or wrong.
You're completely right that you have to be completely invested in this. I bought these off the rack starting with issue 5, and then I worked my way back and got the first 4. The thing with this series was, for the first, I'd say, 10 to 10, 11 issues, they were pretty much, except for one two-parter, they were all one-offs, where you could read them in any order, it didn't matter. Starting about 12, it becomes very soap opera-like, where there's very small details that you have to have read. You can enjoy the story, but you're going to get more out of it if you've read everything. Right. And there was a certain amount of, you know, I was how old? I was maybe 10, 11 when this started coming out. And my cousin was about a year younger than me. And we got into it at the same time. And it was that whole world of buying the figures and buying the playsets and buying the tanks. So it was a very big part of my childhood. And I stuck with it for a good 50 issues. I bailed out in the mid-50s because then it really started to become very sci-fi. I preferred it earlier on when it was very military-like. Right. You know, a lot of people who were into this, they disliked the original figures because, oh, they're just all Green Army men. I kind of liked that they were just Green Army men. It's right. When you got into this weird stuff that I checked out.
Mm.
I enjoyed it. And I, you know, I got all 155 of the original issues. And I picked up the, as it was coming out, the IDW stuff that was a Real American Hero. Because they had several, you know, titles of G.I. Joe. But this right. continued on. And it's still going. Now I think it's Images. The Image, it comes out, it says Image on the cover, but there's another company, Skybox or something,
right.
that is the publisher, and they've picked the numbering up. But the original is the best, I think. I really enjoyed this. I was totally invested in these characters. And it's like everybody's got an arc.
Even yeah, and I think that's probably the whole thing, is if you're familiar with that arc, now you're going to get more out of the story when they say something or do something that's significant to that arc.
And what's funny is, if you refer back to the original issues, the Baroness, she's kind of like a hag, to be blunt with you. If you look at the first issue, she's like, you know, witchy-looking hag. Around this time is when she starts to become quite attractive.
Now, looking at the artwork, you know, because I think that's a good segue to the artwork, I think the drawings of machinery and just kind of detailed things like the candelabra or even the table that they're all sitting at, things like that look to be outstanding. It's the human characters that are not bad, but not up to that level. It just looks like the machinery is really well drawn.
Machinery's fantastic.
The people, the human characters to me look very Herb Trimpe, which is ironic because he was the penciler on the earlier issues of this series. I don't know when he left or whatever. So
they may be his character designs.
Oh, that makes sense. That could very well be. Especially that, you have the opening splash, but the very next page where you've got, what's his name, Hawk? Where he's looking at the checklist as the war games are going on. That looks very, very Herb Trimpe to me.
Yeah, it does. I agree.
Hawk looks like a bit of a cardboard cutout himself. Right
yeah,
there.
Yeah. Yeah, he does.
Hawk looks like what's his name? Quatermain from the Hulk series.
Yeah. Yeah. Who was the guy on the opening splash page, you've got in the bottom left hand corner, you've got the motorcycle with the minigun on the front of it. But what was
Ramp.
The figure that actually came with that?
No figure. You didn't get a figure with that.
Oh, okay.
You got
so the only G.I. Joe toys I ever had was that motorcycle. And I had the guy who was the communications guy.
Breaker.
So was Breaker not normally on the motorcycle?
It was split between mostly rock and roll was the one on the motorcycle.
Because that's who's on it here, right?
Yeah.
That was the only thing that really bugged me. Was like the wrong guy's on the motorcycle, but I guess not. Because I thought he came, the guy I had, I thought came with the motorcycle, but it must be just I bought him or somebody bought it for me. I got him and the motorcycle, so I always associated them as being together, but I guess they actually weren't.
They were brilliant in marketing this because you came out, there were 9 Joes originally who came, you know, off, you bought them on a card. Then there were 3 play sets that didn't come with a figure. There was the motorcycle, there was the jump jet pack, and there was something, and a flat gun. And then there were 3 play sets that came with a figure. It was the missile system came with Hawk, the vamp came with Clutch, and the heavy artillery laser, which disappeared, came with Grand Slam. And then you had the Mobad, which had a motor. It came right with Steeler. That was the original line of Joes.
See,
this had almost everything.
This is where our age difference comes into play, because when I was that age and I had G.I. Joe.
Oh, you were dating.
It was the 12-inch figure with lifelike hair or the kung fu grip. And I remember I had some little pieces of scrap wood that my dad had laying around, and I took them and nailed them together, and I created like a cage. And I had, like, part of the game we were playing was, you know, Joe was a prisoner of war, and the other Joes had to come and rescue him. But, you know, this again, was the totally different toy series.
How many G.I. Joes did you have, like, the big ones?
I think I had 3. And then I had a bunch of outfits, a bunch of guns. I think I had a Jeep. But, again, these were, like, I think they were 12-inch.
Yeah, 12.
I had a ton of original Joe stuff because I had older uncles that, you know, as they, you know, outgrew it or whatever, and they knew I was into it, they just gave them to me. So I had the headquarters where it lift, you know, where it raised up and it had like the spotlight on top. Mm. I had that swamp vehicle.
I would have killed for that.
It's called. I had a ton of the different clothes and outfits, you know, everything from like the astronaut to like the jungle. And I mean, tons of that stuff. It was all hand-me-down stuff, but they kept their toys in really good shape. So, you know, I mean, I had a ton of that. And it's funny, I was just at a comic and toy show this past Saturday, and there was one booth there that had a ton of vintage, you know, of that version, G.I. Joe. And I'm, you know, at first I'm just geeking out looking and seeing all this stuff again for the first time in, you know, 30, 40 years. But then I was looking at the prices and going, oh my God.
It's crazy price.
I mean, a lot of that stuff that I had ended up, you know, we set it on fire. We blew it up with firecracker, you know, all that sort of thing. So, yeah, you know.
I remember I had the G.I. Joe that had the blonde hair, but it was not real hair. It was just a plastic top.
Right.
So it predated the G.I. Joe with the lifelike hair. Then I had the lifelike one, which was just like a thick fuzz.
Flocking.
But he had the, you know, the dark hair and then the beard. And I don't remember. Like I said, I'm pretty sure I had a third one. It might have been a duplicate of one of those.
The only one I've been tempted to get again, just because I loved that figure so much when I was a kid, was they had, and it wasn't the one from the comics, even though he had the same name, but there was a character called Bullet Man.
Yes, I've heard
silver, of that. Silver, what was it, silver legs or silver arms? I forget. I mean, I think it was his arms were silver. And he was part of the G.I. Joe line. I guess the name must have fallen into the public domain or something, because he was not the character from the comics, but he was kind of like a superhero. But I love that figure, Bullet Man. He was just damn cool looking. But anytime I've ever looked one up on eBay, they go for a stupid money. But I'd just love to have one again because I thought he was really cool. But yeah, that stuff's neat. I love that old stuff. See, I could have easily gotten sucked into G.I. Joe as it was coming out. Because like I say, I did have that one figure and the one vehicle. But I distinctly remember, it was either my mother or my father, and I think it was my mother, was basically like, I'm not buying you more shit. It's like, you know, you're already into Star Wars. I'm already getting you all the figures and playsets that we can afford to get you for that, because you're into, you're not getting into something else. So if you're willing to give up Star Wars, you know, then you can get into this other thing. But you're not doing both type of thing. And I'm like, well, I'm not giving up my Star Wars. And then ironically, right around the same time, you know, 83 was right after Jedi came out. You know, at that point, I'm 15 years old. I remember getting two or three figures from Return of the Jedi. I never got any of the play sets or any of the vehicles or anything. And basically, right after that, it's like, all right, I'm too old, you know, and I stopped collecting the stuff. So, you know, it's weird. So I didn't get into Joe because I was still into Star Wars, but then I ended up giving up Star Wars too. So,
the Joe figures for me were, I mean, look, I was a Star Wars kid, you know, I had all that stuff, but there was something about the Joe figures that was they were more realistic. Their knees bent, their elbows bent. After the first wave, their wrists swiveled, so you could actually hold the gun. And by the time Jedi came out, I felt the figures, the best ones had come out already.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of them had. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Well, my only real issue with the issue, because I thought they did a good job of juggling, I mean, a shit ton of characters, for one. You know, giving you a little, you know, you could see where there was the drama and the soap opera stuff going on and everything. And for what is essentially, you know, a toy commercial, I thought they did a really good job with it, with all the different characters except one. And I forget what you said the guy's name was, but who is this doofus in full Frogman outfit starting and it's like,
yeah. Torpedo.
This is like taking Aquaman on the desert mission. What the hell is this guy? Why is he in full Frogman apparel in the middle of the U.S. Treasury for?
Because he's a SEAL and he's a new figure that they came out with.
Exactly. And that's what it reeks of, is that he's a new figure. We're going to make him look like the figure, despite the fact he totally doesn't fit this environment that he's in.
Why would you be wearing flippers inside the
truck? He's getting shot at with a machine. You know, these guys have automatic weapons. They're shooting right at him, and this asshole's wearing flippers. He's going to get murdered. He can't get away fast enough. Not to mention the fact he's wearing a full, you know, face mask, goggles, and a rebreather, yet he doesn't have a tank on his back. I wish he did, because my joke for this would be, I know what I'm aiming at. I'm going to shoot him in the tank and watch his ass blow up, just like the shark in Jaws, you know? Plus, the weapon he's armed with is a harpoon.
And?
How impractical is that versus people that have automatic machine guns?
How do you like that these three, you know, special forces, for lack of a better term, allowed the two security guys to just get murdered before they decide they're going to step in and do anything.
Right.
Oh, yeah, the Treasury Police. Expendable.
Now, I don't know what the circumstances would have been or whatever. I'm at a complete loss for this, because I did not recognize the cover to this book. I didn't remember or recognize, like, the first several pages, but when it got to the point where it's the pouring down rain, you've got Hawk and the general are out in front of the Capitol building, and then the one soldier, you know, he's looking up in the sky, he says, "Take cover, Cobra aircraft coming in low and fast." I remember going, those are drones. Mm-hmm. This is a false, and I remembered, wait, I've read this before. So I don't know if we covered this on the show or we meant to cover it on the show. So I can't think of any other circumstance where I would have read this book before, but I knew what was happening. And I remember going, yeah, this is familiar. I've read this before. So I thought that was really weird. And I did kind of remember the Frogman guy, because he always stands out to me as like, what is this guy doing? But the rest of it I didn't really remember, but I definitely remember that part of the story.
The Frogman's like Flippa Dippa.
Right.
Wait till one of the characters gets married and he comes to the wedding dressed like that.
Oh.
I'm kidding.
So I do want to know, feel free to spoil, I guess. I want to know what's going on with the Baroness. Does she die here? Does she wind up horribly disfigured? What happens here?
She survives. She's held prisoner, all bandaged up like a mummy. And Major Blood is a prisoner as well. And he escapes and takes her with him to use as a pawn, you know, with Destro, since he tried to kill him. He brings her to Switzerland, and she becomes Hot Baroness after plastic surgery.
On page 20 of the scan, is that supposed to be the Washington Monument? Because it must be cold out that night or something, because it's way too small to be the Washington Monument.
Well, so you can't drive that close to it.
Right. That was pretty much all I had, though. I mean, it was okay. I can see where this would have been, you know, really exciting, you know, for kids reading it, you know, back in its day. I can see where somebody that was invested in it, you know, what they see in it type of thing. It, you know, this is one. It's also one of those things where I can see getting sucked in personally, and I have purposely avoided that for years because I don't need another collecting project.
Now think about the concept behind this of spreading a virus with the money.
Right.
And how when COVID hit, one of the first things they told us was, oh, don't worry, it can't spread through money.
Hmm. Sure it can.
Yeah, that's why all these places became cashless and only take credit cards right now.
Right.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, I don't have any deep thoughts on this, sadly, but I'm ready to rate it if you are.
Sure, go ahead, Dave. It's your book.
And don't let the fact that Scott and I hate it influence you at all.
Well, starting with the cover, I'm going to be honest, I'm not a fan of the cover. Because to me, it's a warped version of what happens in the issue. It looks like, you know, they're riding in the back of the Hiss pickup truck version. It's in the daytime when it's night. The characters look slightly off. The coloring's off. It's just not a draw. However, the story I like. I followed this along. This was a buy where you would go to the newsstand, because it wasn't a comic book shop, and you were waiting for the next part to drop. And the build up to this, I couldn't wait for this issue. I almost think this was one of the ones, and I might be wrong, that they had a commercial for on television.
Ah.
I'm not sure about it, but they might have. And the story I thought was pretty good, because it picks up this storyline about the virus has been going on a couple of issues. The training sequence I thought was kind of doofy, the initial part, with the two-dimensional pop-up things. I can't even imagine where they're doing this training, since they're supposedly based at Fort Wadsworth on Staten Island. the radio control tanks, I can see that's going to be wonderful for the budget. What is cool, though, where they unveil the Wolverine, their latest product, and they have the sequence of one, two, three, five scenes where they're showing you the tanks get blown up. If you actually look at them, you see the missiles hitting eight of them and then two just exploding on their own. CoverGirl, I never thought was particularly attractive in this issue, and she's supposed to be a supermodel. I'm kind of rolling the story and the art into one. Like I said, I find it fascinating. The Cobra aspect is kind of cool. It's like the Imperials are kind of cooler at some point with the uniforms and stuff. And I felt that carries into this too. The Arbco Trucking Company, a play on Cobra, of course. Military stuff in DC I like. General Flag was always one of my favorite characters. Unfortunately, spoiler, he's only going to have 3 more appearances. And overall, my ratings would be on the cover a C. The story, on the other hand, I'm going to give it an A minus. I really enjoyed it. The interior art, while some of the characters are a little off and a little funky, the equipment is great. The scenery is great. I'm giving it a B for an overall grade of a B plus.
Were they in the Marvel Universe? Did they?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
Because I knew that they crossed over with the Transformers at one point in Marvel, but
and
I
even that's like iffy. They did cross over, but depending on what you read afterward, it's like, did it really happen or did it not?
Okay.
Because
it was kind of the same way in Transformers. I mean, I don't know a lot about Marvel Transformers, but I think the only issue I've ever had of that series is the one where black-suited Spider-Man crossed over with them. And I think that was kind of treated the same way. Like, later on, it was never referenced again and all that sort of thing. So they were kind of nebulously in the Marvel Universe, but not really I think, something like that. So.
There is an issue of G.I. Joe number 10, where they bail out of a plane. And they parachute down and land on the Hulk. and it's a guy with a mask on. And as they leave, they say, wasn't it nice of that Marvel representative to lend us the money to get back to Staten Island?
I'll go next. My grades are I'm just going to be short and sweet on this. I'm going to go C plus all around. I kind of dig the cover, except for the fact of Destro does have 2 arms, right?
Yes.
Where's his other arm?
It looks to me like it's supposed to be kind of wrapped around the other dude's right arm, like holding the arm with the gun to keep him from... But it's definitely at a weird angle.
Yeah. Yeah, that was really my only issue with the cover. I kind of dig the cover.
If you look, you could see kind of an elbow at the back sticking out.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of odd. I like the interior art for the reasons you said. I thought the equipment, there's absolutely nothing wrong with, like, the equipment. The vehicles and the equipment, the toys look great, I think. It's the figure work is not all that great, especially faces and that sort of thing. But, as far as like, vehicles, settings, that sort of thing, and the action, I thought was, it's perfectly acceptable. And the story, I don't know, I'm trying to be fair with the story. It's just, I didn't really know what the hell was going on, and I'm not all that familiar with the characters, but I mean, it was interesting enough for what it was. So, yeah, I'll say a C plus.
I'm a little harsher on the cover. I just feel like it's not dynamic enough. I think it might look better if the background wasn't so bright. It almost looks like a just a nice day, and we're wrestling in the park, But I'm just going to say a straight up C. It's not a bad cover. It's not a good cover. It's just a cover, The interior art, I am torn because you do have to rate it as a whole. The actual characters are not badly drawn, but they're okay. So for the characters, I feel like it's, you know, they're okay. It's a C. But the equipment is outstanding. Like, the equipment is an A. So I'm going to give it a C+ based on the equipment bringing up the characters, but I do kind of feel like the characters are more important, so I can't let it bring it up too high. The story, you know, we joke around when we talk about the, you know, the old edict of every comic could be somebody's first, and I don't mind when they don't go by that, but it's hard for me to pick up a story, you know, a book in the middle and just, you know, get pulled in. You know, when I first started reading comics, I remember, you know, I picked up a bunch of stories or issues that were in the middle of a storyline, and I really caught on pretty quick to what was going on and everything, and I didn't have that feel here. So I think it lacks for that reason, but I do think, you know, that if you were following it and you were involved in it, it seems to have a decent flow to it. So I'm going to say a C on the story just because it didn't pull me in. And overall, I'll give the book a C+.
Be honest, though. Wouldn't you like to see a skit of this Cobra dinner in the truck, in the back of the truck, with the thing rocking back and forth and stuff rolling off the table? You can't even drink out of a glass in a car. You have a dinner in the back of the truck.
Yeah, you could see that in a
the chandelier swinging.
You could see that like in an Austin Powers movie. So,
all right, what book we got next?
Well, you wanted to punish me by doing yours.
Okay.
just by way of full disclosure, yours took about 3 minutes to read.
Yes. Yeah. It is very short. So when we hit upon the idea of making this, you know, kind of a toy themed episode, you know, I didn't want to be predictable because I thought the predictable thing would be to go with like Micronauts, and I was like, I don't want to be predictable. Let's go with something else. So I had two, you know, thoughts right off the top of my head, but the first one was. I know in my collection somewhere I have at least one issue, and I think it's the first issue of there was a toy line called Total Justice. It was a DC Comics based you know, figure line, and they actually did do a, I think it was a 3-issue miniseries. So I thought, you know, I've never read that. Let me check that out. And I pulled up a scan of the issue that I had, started flipping through it, and I was like, oh, no, this is going to take way more energy than I've got right now to do this one, because the art looked rough and the story looked like it was probably really rough. So I was like, what else can I do? And I remembered something that I picked up not long ago. So for this one here, my book is, if you go by the Indicia, and this book's kind of a nightmare as far as like finding it in the CLZ app or for like filing purposes, because I file all my books strictly alphabetical by whatever the Indicia says, which makes this series that this book is a part of a complete nightmare, because every one of them, the name in the Indicia is actually the title of the story rather than whatever the cover says. So it's a whole thing with me. But anyway, by the Indicia, the name of this book is simply Doom Link. If you look at the cover, it actually says Superman, Man of Steel, co-starring Batman, the ultimate crime-fighting team. So this was published, of course, by DC Comics. Cover date on this is simply just 1995. The approximate on-sale date, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, was January 1st, 1995. So there's no cover price on the issue because it was packaged and available exclusively with an action figure 2-pack of Cyberlink Superman and Cyberlink Batman from the 90s Superman Man of Steel toy line. So were you guys familiar with that toy line? Nada? No?
I mean, I've heard of it, yeah.
It was actually a pretty cool toy line for its time. I'll talk more about that a little bit later. So with this particular book, there's actually two editions of this comic. And as, so far as I can determine, the only difference between them is that one reads Kenner Limited Edition in what I'd normally call the price box, you know, up in the top left corner there next to the number one. And the other one, the one that we're going to be looking at, says Kenner Platinum Edition in that same box and has a silver or, I guess, platinum border around the edges of the same artwork on the front cover. So exactly the same except for that border on the platinum one. Cover on this is by John Byrne, which I'm pretty sure is how it originally came to my attention in the first place, because, you know, I'm a Byrne fan, but I'm, you know, definitely a mark for John Byrne doing Superman. It's not his best work, but I still think it's a pretty cool image. It's a grim-faced, long-haired Superman and an equally grim-faced Batman charging right at us, the reader, wearing alternate versions of their usual costumes. And overall, I really dig it. I think it's pretty striking. I really like the colors, and I like the alternate outfits that they're wearing. Incidentally, for what it's worth, this same toy line would release another two-pack also featuring Cyberlink Superman and Cyberlink Batman in slightly different versions of these alternate costumes the following year. But the collectible bonus as part of that two-pack was actually a trading card, not a comic book. So a little bit different than this. Anyway, Doomlink is the name of our story. It was written by James Owsley when he was going by Christopher Priest, or is that the other way around? I'm not sure. Penciler is Eduardo Barreto. Inkers were Dick Giordano and Mike DiCarlo, so a nice pedigree on this. Colors by Tom McGraw. Letters by Gasper, who I think is Gasper Saladino. And it doesn't say who the editor was. So to start this off, I'm just going to read you what it says on the inside front cover as kind of an introduction to this whole thing. So it says, in Elseworld stories, heroes are taken from their usual setting and put into strange times and places, some that have existed or might have existed, and others that can't, couldn't, or shouldn't exist. This special adventure of the ultimate crime-fighting team is one of them. On this Elseworlds, the Superman you know changed forever when a kryptonite meteor, harmless to humans but deadly to Superman, slammed into Earth and its fragments were flung far and wide. Now, with kryptonite radiation saturating the environment, Superman's aura of invulnerability has faded. But the Cyberlink armor he now wears generates a synthetic invulnerability field that makes him just as powerful as ever. And now the Man of Steel has a partner in his war on crime. That's because the Batman you know is, in this Elseworlds, based in Metropolis and has joined forces with Superman to form the ultimate crime-fighting team. So we turn the page and the story starts proper. It says, in the skies over Metropolis, the Vulture, Lex Luthor, is being pursued by the Man of Steel. He unleashes a surprise spray of kryptonite acid at our hero, but Superman shrugs it off, bragging about his swanky Cyberlink armor and how it generates an invulnerability field that repels the attack. He and Luthor banter back and forth a bit, then Luthor ducks through a space warp to avoid capture. Superman attempts to follow, but badoinks off in an unseen barrier and bonks his head. Pissed off, he whirls on the instigator of the barrier, who happens to be the Batman, and demands an explanation. Batman, likewise adorned in a more armored outfit than we normally see him wear, and hanging off the side of the Batwing, says he extended Superman's invulnerability field by utilizing his own Cyberlink controls to block Superman's access to the warp because Luthor was leading him into a trap. Well, obviously, says Superman, but that still doesn't answer my question. We've been partners long enough to know not to get in each other's way. Partners, but not quite friends, eh? Responds Batman. And we get a brief insight into the nature of their relationship in this reality. Batman asks Superman to accompany him to coordinates his cyberlink armor is transmitting while he tells a story of having earlier that day, as Bruce Wayne, overheard some country club buddies of his bragging about making a killing in new technology and overhearing the specific term cyberlink. Some investigating has led him to Luthor, and Superman says that he was at work as Clark Kent when he heard of Luthor's attack on Star Labs. So this is how they met up at the same time at the same place. They track Luthor to his lair where the villain is having a hissy fit because Superman didn't follow him through the warp and fall into his trap. Batman confronts Luthor and distracts him with fisticuffs while Superman plays with Luthor's computer. Batman zaps Luthor with his wrist laser, which I find both not very Batman-like and also pretty freaking cool at the same time, because it's just a really neat-looking panel. Anyway, the blast knocks Luthor's winged flying harness thing off his back, where it transforms into an autonomous hornet-looking thing and blasts Batman. One pissed-off Superman busts through the wall and orders Luthor to back off. He laser visions the Hornet thing just as it unleashes a blast that knocks him out of the sky. Luthor stands over the fallen heroes and begins to gloat, but turn the page, and the good guys climb to their feet all smug and smiles. It was a clever ruse. Luthor's computer is disabled. The world's finest team's armor and invulnerability shields are working just fine. Luthor summons another space warp and ducks out. Superman scoops up Batman, who can't help but notice that the Man of Steel seems to be in a better mood. "Yeah, I guess I am now," says Superman. "By the way, friend, is it too late to tell Luthor I reset his transporter to land him in city jail?" Cue the Star Trek do-do-do-do-do-do-do music. That's the end. Whew. I have both versions of this book. I acquired the original one actually way back in the 90s when these figures would have been brand new coming out on the stands, because I was buying the figures as I could find them for my oldest son, Scotty, when he was just a little shaver at the time. But I just thought the figures were really cool. They were very contemporaneous with kind of what was happening with Superman at the time, most of them anyway. And I remember specifically getting this two-pack, giving him the figures, and I kept the comics type of thing. But when I became aware recently that this Platinum Edition existed, just because it was, hitting that completionist, button in me, I wanted a copy of it, even knowing it probably wasn't any different at all other than the cover. Anyway, I finally acquired the Platinum Edition just this past March it was one of those, one day local dealer show type of things. Got it for a mere $15, still sealed, mint on the card, everything. So I thought that was pretty cool. Kenner released at least three other action figure two packs with a bonus comic in it that were part of this series. And they were, there's one called Doomsday is Coming. It's by Dan Jurgens and Brett Breeding. Came with the figures of Doomsday, and then Superman in that outfit that he wore in Superman Doomsday. I think it was called Hunter Prey, that the Prestige miniseries, which was pretty cool. There was one called Target Superman, which is also by Dan Jurgens, and art by Barry Kitson, which looks really fantastic. That one came with the villain called Massacre, which I bet most folks don't even remember these days. Big red-looking dude. Kind of looked like Mongol. And then it had a standard-looking Superman figure, although he was sporting the long hair that he had at the time. And then there's one called Shark Attack, which I've never actually seen. I don't own it, and I cannot find a scan of it anywhere, but I'm very curious. I'd love to own this. According to mycomicshop.com, because Mike's Amazing World has no information on this comic whatsoever, but according to mycomicshop.com, it says, Kenner Limited Edition Promotional Comic Never Released with a Toy. So that makes me wonder, then, how was it released? Was it like a promo given out at like KB Toys or something? I don't know. But it was Superboy versus King Shark. Like this, it was short. It says it was just simply a 10-page story written by Barbara Kessel, art by Tom Grummett and Doug Hazelwood. So I would love to get my hands on that sometime. But I can find precious little on it. It has been up on eBay before, but it's been so long ago, I couldn't even find like what it had sold for at the time. So I'm thinking this is it's got to be a pretty rare item. But yeah, that's it as far as like the history of this whole thing. But yeah, the figures are out there, and from what I've seen, the figures are still fairly cheap. I guess they're just not all that desirable or collectible or what, but I thought some of the figures in the series were pretty cool. They had Superboy that actually looks pretty neat, you know, with the jacket and everything. Mm-hmm. I forget what all the other figures were that they had in the series. But something that struck me as really odd with this is, okay, so this is set in an Elseworlds, which off the top of my head, I think this is the only one of the ones that came with a comic that specifically told you that this was an Elseworlds tale and that these were Elseworlds characters. And I find that really odd because the Luther that's in this story, there was a figure of that Luthor. So it makes it like, if you were to just pick up that Luthor as part of the series, it makes it feel like it's part of the series, but it can't really be because he's from this same alternate world, I guess. So it was just really odd to me, and I'm like, why did they even bother to set this in an Elseworlds thing? Because I would think that wouldn't kind of the purpose or one of the ideas behind a toy line like this was like to introduce new people to Superman and his world and his friends and his characters. So no. You know what I mean? It just strikes
no, the purpose is to repaint the figures we've got and sell them again. That's the purpose of this.
Right. Yeah. Now what, do you guys have any familiarity with this at all, or what did you think of it?
I had zero familiarity with this. I had no clue that it even existed. So I had no connection to the figures themselves as I was reading this, and just read it for the purposes of the, you know, see what the comic had to offer us. It struck me, well, the cover, you know, it's John Byrne. So bad John Byrne is good. You know, there's really no truly bad John Byrne. But it strikes me almost as if somebody commissioned him to do a Superman-Batman picture. It doesn't really feel like his total heart was in it, but, you know, it's still good. The story itself, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the vulture for Luther, because that's what I thought as I was reading it. I'm sure that we aren't unique in that regard. I mean, the look is just a little too much. The story seemed very simplistic to me, as is what you probably would want for a comic that's coming with a toy. See, so the question to me is, are you marketing this to the toy collector, in which case you could have had a somewhat more sophisticated story, or are you marketing it truly to children, in which case this is, you know, this is fine. My only qualm with it is it's fine, but it's not really presenting the characters in the way that I want, so that children are going to be into them in the future and want to, you know, want to get more. It almost feels like it's creating its own little universe and just happy to be there. And, you know, thank you for producing our toys. I can't, the story doesn't get very deep. I can't get too deep in the analysis of it. It's fine, you know. The artwork is okay. Reminds me of kind of 90s-ish artwork. So, you know, it was much like G.I. Joe. It was an okay read, but it didn't really do a lot for me.
Right.
I had totally checked out on comics and toys at this point in the mid-90s. So I might have noticed there was toys, but it wasn't to the level of that I was going to go to Toys R Us and take a look. To me, okay, here's some of the problems I have with this story.
Pull up a chair.
So now a kryptonite media hits the Earth and floods the atmosphere with kryptonite radiation. Why is he not just dead?
Right.
Okay, yep. So now that's one. So he's depowered now. He's just a regular person, right? But the cyberlink suit is what gives him his powers, right?
I guess.
So in theory, Batman's got the same powers as Superman now. One, why does he need a Batwing? Two, we can make another suit and have Darby Dickels there as well. How fantastic would that be?
No.
I mean, no.
See, I'm surprised. Now, you know, of course, you know, this is an audio medium, so, you know, the listeners can't see what we're seeing or whatever. But, you know, sitting here, you know, having this conversation, looking at you, and you have this entire wall behind you of Superman action figures and collectibles, I'm stunned that this is not on your radar in any way whatsoever. This series, I mean, not necessarily this comic book, but this series that the comic comes from, because, again, I actually thought rather a lot of the Man of Steel line. I thought they did some really good figures and some good work on this.
I'm surprised this one has to take a look.
What's that?
I'm going to have to take a look at this.
Yeah. Now, again, I brought this just simply because it immediately popped in my mind as something that I had. It's literally hanging on my wall. It's, you know, you can't, it's out of the camera view, but that's why I picked this. I had no emotional attachment to it other than it's something that I own. If I'd ever read it before, it made no impression. I couldn't remember having ever read it before. So, you know, feel free to, you know, be brutally honest about it. My opinion of it was it's completely forgettable. The story was kind of dopey. It didn't really make a whole lot of sense. But where I will disagree with Paul, I was rather impressed with the art. I like Eduardo Barreto. It's funny because back during the time when he sporadically did some Superman stuff, like in the regular titles and everything, I never thought much of his stuff. I mean, I didn't dislike it, but it just never made much of an impression. But now these days, whenever I find, back issues or what with his art in a Superman title, I continue to be really impressed. Like, why didn't this guy hit more with me? Because I really do like his stuff. And I think he did a really good job with this. There's several panels in this and several poses with both Batman and Superman that I really like in this. You know, the opening splash I think is very cool. Now, again, Luthor's outfit is kind of goofy. He actually looks more to me like Vulture 2099 from the mm-hmm. 2099.
Yeah, exactly.
Universe. But Superman charging in out of that, whatever that is. I know what it is. It's his force field is becoming visible as I thought he was coming out of like a boom tube or something, but what it is the acid is making his force field visible as it hits it. That's what it is. But it's very cool. I like that shot. And there's a couple other shots like that too. When he comes charging through the wall in Luthor's headquarters, I thought that was pretty cool. I love that shot of Batman firing the laser, and I really shouldn't, because Batman using any sort of I guess technically this is still a firearm, shouldn't really work. That shouldn't really be a thing. But somehow I like that. I really like that shot. I think it looks cool. And while I don't feel like either one of these characters really needs, a different costume or what, if they ever were going to have other costumes or alternate outfits or whatever, I kind of dig both of these, to be perfectly honest. I like this look for Superman. It's different, I kind of like it. What do you think of the outfits?
There's some scenes where it looks like they don't even have capes, and then some that it seems like they do have capes.
Batman does take his cape off. So, okay. Again, the pages aren't numbered, but page 9 of the scan where he's facing off with Luthor, Superman's like smashing through the wall in the top right corner right there, Batman, you can see him holding his cape in his hand. So he actually takes his cape off to battle Luthor.
All right, that's my eyes.
Yeah, Superman took his off too. Now that I look at it, yeah.
I guess the capes are removable on the action figures.
Yes, they are. Yep.
Look at this. I'm not a fan of the costumes. No? They feel very, very 90s to me. They feel like, you know, why don't you just add some pockets and some more guns and things on them.
The picture on page 12, it looks like Batman's hitting him with a building.
Yeah, I thought he that is. Too.
Yeah, he is, because they're in the background there that's like a diorama or something. And so, yeah, Batman does pick up a model building and smacks Superman with it. Yeah, he's demonstrating that his invulnerability is still working.
How great would it be if it went out?
He just clocks him in the back of the head.
Boom. Or they shut off the portal thing as Luthor's going through and severs his arm and his leg. Oops. Yeah, for me, the costumes, I agree with Paul. They're very 90s. To me, it's clearly like, okay, we have these figures. You got to come up with something that's completely different so we can sell more.
Right. Well, I tell you, this outfit for Superman, I like this a hell of a lot more than that one he had for a time in the comics, the one with all the extra lines and didn't have the trunks and everything.
Trunks.
I think this one kind of looks cool. I like the black, I don't know what it's supposed to be, slacks or leotard or whatever it's supposed to be.
The corduroys.
Yeah. It's kind of cool.
As he rescues people, you hear that sound.
All right, well, are you ready for grades on this?
Sure.
All right, I want to love the cover so much, and I like it. I don't love it. I love John Byrne. His Superman is my Superman. But unfortunately, by this point, this is where I feel like Byrne had he was kind of losing it. You know, he just wasn't what he used to be. And I don't know. It's okay. It's just not up to that standard of when, you know, he was doing Superman proper back in, you know, 86, 87. So it's serviceable. It's okay. It's like Paul said, it feels like a commission. You know, it feels like a convention sketch turned into a cover type of thing. So it's okay. It's not great. I'm going to say a B- on it. What I really do like about it is, again, I love the way it's colored. I think the coloring really pops and looks very, very cool. The interior art, I dig it. I think the interior art's fantastic. I really, and I think to me, that was kind of the saving grace of this, was the interior art. And I really like the page of Luthor having the little hissy fit in his headquarters before the heroes pop in, because this page right here feels very Ross Andrew to me, like right out of like that Treasury that we looked at, you know, Superman and his amazing Fortress of Solitude. Yeah, that's mm-hmm. kind of what it feels like. I'm getting a real Ross Andrew vibe off of that. So I dig the art. I think it looks pretty good. Art wise, I think I'm going to go, I'll go a B+ on the art. I really dig it. Story, the story's goofy. I mean, it's meant to just, you know, tell a quick story to introduce kids to the characters and maybe sell some action figures and maybe sort of have get you invested. I'm just a little perplexed by why do the whole Elseworlds thing. I think there's, you could just as easily have them in different outfits in the main universe, introduce the kids properly to the characters in the main universe, and even sort of maybe tie it into current continuity just by explaining it differently. You know, they're wearing these alternate outfits because something, you know, whatever. So story-wise, it's a middle-of-the-road C. It's kind of there. Overall grade on this, though, I will say I'm actually going to go a B- on it, because I dig it. I really do like the art quite a lot. I love, you know, the cover in concept. And packaged with the figures, I think the figures look fantastic. I really like the figures as part of this series as well, if that counts towards the whole grade on it. So, yeah, overall, B-.
Okay. I'm going to now tear that to shreds.
of course you are.
Again, as I said, you know, John Byrne, it's always going to be, you know, even bad John Byrne isn't bad. But to me, this cover is a C. It's not really standing out. It's not exceptional Byrne in any way. It looks like a commission. And if I owned it, I'd be happy to own it. But I don't, you know, I wouldn't seek it out, put it that way. The interior art, it's clean. It does the job. I understand why you like it. It's just, I don't know, there's something about it that just doesn't, it feels too cluttered some points, and I don't like the designs on some of it. There's some parts where I really do like it. If you look at page 9 of the scan in the middle panel, I really like the way Batman looks there in his different costume. I just think it looks very cool. So there are things about it that I like. I'm going to say a B- for me on the artwork. It's, you know, it's still not bad at all. But it's just not necessarily what I would have them do with it. The story really loses me. It's overly simple. It doesn't really make me feel anything about what's going on. The most interesting thing to me is when Batman says partners but not quite friends, where like you feel like you could really develop something with that. But it doesn't really go anywhere anyway. So the story just really, I'm going to say a C- on the story. It just doesn't do anything for me. And I'm going to give the book overall a C+.
I'm kind of there with you. To me, the cover, I mean, it's not bad. To me, this whole book, it's not Superman. If you name these characters something else, it would be... Batman comes off more Batman-like to me than Superman. And I kind of think the Batman costume is kind of cool. I could see that as a variation. But Superman, I don't like the costume. It's too off. I'm not a fan of long-haired Superman to begin with. Yeah. That's probably why I wasn't so big on him in the 90s. But, I mean, the cover looks like, okay, get together. We're going to take a snapshot here. Make sure we're both all in the frame. But the art is good. It's John Byrne art. I'd give the cover a solid B-. The interior art, it's like I said, if it wasn't Superman, I think I'd enjoy it more. Again, on the interior art, Batman comes off to me is looking cooler. I get a kick out of the difference in the art where they're, you know, oh, earlier today while I was Bruce Wayne, it's like almost a different style and a different coloring. It's like flat compared to the what's live, so to speak.
Right.
The one who comes off to me who's right on mark is Lex Luthor. He's on model. So overall, I would give the interior art, and then give it a B- as well. The story is, it's wacky. It's a goofy story. I poked enough holes in it. I'm going to give the story a C- for an overall grade of a C+.
Do we have time for a third book?
I do.
It's up to you.
I just don't want to give it the short shrift. On the other hand, I don't want to go too long. We can give it a shot. So, going with our toy theme, I, unlike Scott, was perfectly willing to be predictable and picked ROM number 18. The cover is, well, I guess actually I should start with the, it was released on February 17th, 1981, and had a cover date of May of 1981. The cover is by Frank Miller and inked by Terry Austin. It shows ROM shooting at a monstrous figure while the X-Men are engaged in battle with the figure amid a blizzard. The story is called And a Child Shall Deceive Them, and it is, the writing credit on the Marvel Wikipedia is Bill Mantlos, Sal Buscema, Chris Claremont, and Joe Duffy. It's penciled by Sal Buscema, inked by Al Milgrom, Frank Giacoya, and Sal Buscema, colored by Ben Shawn, lettered by Michael Higgins, and edited by Al Milgrom and Jack Abel. So we got a lot of hands working on this one. And just by way of background, in the previous issue, we meet a family of sorts, where the father is a dire wraith who has kind of adapted to human customs and adapted a human form, and he met a woman and he married her, he fell in love, and he was living as a human, and they had a baby who is a mutant combination of the two, who is known as Hybrid. I could also call him Prius, I guess. And he kills his parents and is ready to just cause devastation, and ROM comes to the rescue, but the child is, I believe, supposed to be 15 years old, and he adopts his human form as the X-Men come, and they see ROM as being the mutant that showed up on their Cerebro, and they just assume he's trying to kill this child. So, now, to go with the Marvel Wiki synopsis, just to make Scott's head explode, I will read that one, because I still work and I didn't have time to do a synopsis of my very own. So, the X-Men stand ready to defend the young Jimmy Marks, who, unbeknownst to them, is actually the half-human, half-wraith Hybrid. As the team springs into action, Hybrid uses his mental powers to usurp Storm's control of weather and creates a blinding blizzard. While Sprite stays close to Jimmy Marks, Colossus, Nightcrawler, and Wolverine press an uncoordinated attack. Hybrid launches a number of farm implements at ROM and Wolverine. Nightcrawler teleports Wolverine to safety, and the implements impact harmlessly on the Space Knight. ROM searches through the storm to find the hulking shape of Hybrid rising behind the young Sprite. As ROM approaches, Sprite turns and spots the horror, instinctively phasing through the Galadorian and disrupting his circuitry. Colossus grapples with Hybrid, who uses his abilities to revert Peter to his human form and begins asphyxiating him. Nightcrawler keeps Peter alive while Wolverine once again confronts ROM. Sprite tells Wolverine about the true enemy, Hybrid, as ROM once again grapples with his foe. His neutralizer is knocked towards Wolverine, who picks up the weapon, but is severely jolted when he tries to fire it. Then Sprite, in desperation, picks up the neutralizer, and due to her unique phasing ability, is able to fire it. Unfortunately, it was only set on stun, and Hybrid comes to destroy her. But ROM holds him back and instructs Sprite how to retune the weapon to its highest setting. She fires again, blasting apart Hybrid's molecules, but also opening the dimensional rift to Limbo, where ROM, bathed in his own weapon's beam, then falls through. With the destruction of Hybrid, the storm ceases, and the X-Men depart, leaving ROM's neutralizer lying in the snow. So now, we go back to the days of ROM being a Marvel comic, and I've made no bones about it, and I don't think Scott has either, that I loved this series when it was coming out. One of the things I did like about Rom and the Micronauts is they planted them firmly in the Marvel Universe. And I always thought that was very, very cool, because you'd have these crossovers. I'm going to start you know, my critique with the cover. And I know a lot of people don't like Frank Miller for his actual renditions of the people. They prefer the moodiness of his art, or the, you know, just the storytelling in his art. But I think this particular cover is extremely sharp, in my opinion. I'm going to give some of that to Terry Austin, you know, eliminating the rough edges of the Miller artwork. But the layout, the atmosphere of it, I just think this is an awesome cover. Then in the story itself, I have to say I don't really care for the inking as it's presented in this story. Sal Buscema, I think, is an excellent storyteller and does a great job of layouts, but I've said before, and I guess I will say again, that he needs a strong inker to make his artwork really pop. And I don't feel the inking here is doing it justice. I think the layouts, again, the storytelling are really good, but the actual inking and final product is a little underwhelming. The story is really good as far as I'm concerned. It really brought me into it. The thing about it is I didn't think Mantlo really wanted to get too much into the X-Men's soap opera-ness. So he doesn't really delve into their thought process, into their actions, as much as just we're focused on Rom, and these are guest stars in the book. They aren't co-stars. You know, this isn't an evenly divided book. Rom is still the star of the book, and it's presented that way. So it's kind of interesting to see that as the progression. They are more of, for the most part, an obstacle for him than, again, co-stars. We have our traditional Marvel superheroes have to fight each other when they meet. But then, you know, eventually they realize the common ground. But by the time they realize the common ground, they never get a chance to actually become friends of sorts. You know, because Rom gets thrown into limbo. I'm a little surprised that he ended off with them leaving his neutralizer in the snow, because you would think they would be aware that that was a pretty powerful weapon, and that they wouldn't leave it there. But as with many stories that we've reviewed of late, it leaves me wanting more. Like, okay, Rom is in limbo now. What's going to happen? And it makes you want to pick up the next issue, as far as I'm concerned. So this had me geeking out to an extent. And I hope I'm doing justice to it in my description of what I thought of it. I make no bones about it. I love this whole series.
Dave? I never want to hear about G.I. Joe that you didn't understand what was going on.
I knew you were going to go there. I knew it.
I don't want to ever hear that again. I had never read an issue of Rom Space Knight, and I've read very few issues of the X-Men. I came into this, I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah, but you know what? That's your shortcoming. My not reading G.I. Joe, no big deal. You're not reading this, you're losing.
I thought when they said at the beginning, 15 years ago, an infant was born, I thought that was Rom's backstory.
That's one of the things, actually, that was one of my comments, too, that I didn't make, was he's supposed to be 15 years old, but the way they're drawing him, you would think he was 10.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that too. His physical depiction doesn't really match what they're telling you about him. You know, you had said that I'm a big Rom fan, and that is very true. But I think my Rom story is a little weird, only because for the longest time I was a Rom fan from a distance. Because I didn't read Rom back in the day. I remember it being on the stands. I remember him being out. I remember thinking he was a really cool character.
Very cool looking, I'll tell you.
Yeah, very cool looking. Very cool. I always wanted the action figure. But I think for the longest time, I owned a grand total of one issue of Rom, and it's the one where... I'm trying to remember what the verbiage is on the cover. Let's see. I had Mike's Amazing World pulled up. Let's see if give me just a second. I want to say it was like issue 70. Nope, that's not right. It was the one where like the word spaceman was crossed out and it said like human or something like that.
I know the one you're talking about.
43, it says, it's showing Rom's armors laying on the ground, and like this man is doing the pose from the Green Mile, you know, that sort of pose. And he's yelling at the sky. He says, "Freed of this armor, at last I'm Rom." And the word space, the word knight as part of space knight is crossed out, and it says space man. I don't remember what the story was now, but for the longest time, that was the only issue I actually owned. But this was one of the first series in recent times where I kept seeing issues in the discount bins, mostly 50-cent bins. I just kept seeing them there and finally decided one day, like, I wonder if I could collect the whole series out of the cheap bins, because I just keep seeing them all the time. And this was always a character I was interested in, so why the hell not? And I started doing that, and it took me, I don't know, maybe a couple of years. But I did eventually, it's one of the few where I started that project and actually completed it from the disc, because what's happened to me many times is that I'll start it out of the cheap bins, and then invariably there's at least one issue that I end up having to pay through the nose for, because there's always that one issue that's like worth a lot of money that I didn't know about. Like the Spectre was like that, because there's that one issue of the Spectre that's the first appearance of Mr. Terrific. I ended up paying pardon me, quite a bit for that, you know, just to own that one issue. But with Rom, I did collect it all for a dollar or less an issue, most of them for like 50 cents. And then unlike most of these projects, I actually read it, you know, once I had them all, I sat down and I read the entire series, and I gotta say, I friggin' loved it. I thought it was a great read from beginning to end. I think it's probably Bill Mantlo's finest work, honestly. And that's saying a lot, cause I think the world of Bill Mantlo, I think the guy had an incredible imagination. I mean, this is the guy that created basically the Micronauts' entire world and story out of, you know, just out of his head. Same thing with Rom. I mean, he was given basically an action figure in a very thin outline and created this incredible, rich universe. You know, I know that they say that there's, you know, all this fatigue these days with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but before the whole thing's done, damn, I wish they'd bring this character in. I know that Marvel doesn't own him, or there's some weird thing going
Somebody
on.
Somebody else is publishing him today.
They were, yeah. I don't know that they still, because didn't something happen where They at least just recently reprinted Rom finally.
Yeah, they got the rights, I think, for a limited time where they were able to reprint the issues in, I'm not even sure what format they reprinted them, but they definitely had at least for a short time, they had the license again.
But that was just reprinting license, right?
Yeah,
don't have the license.
I don't think they came out with anything new.
Yeah, that's a shame, because... you know, I'd love to see them, whether they could buy him and own him outright and make him truly a Marvel character, or just sign a new licensing deal to, you know, to bring him back into the fold, you know, temporarily, one way or the other. I would love that, but I definitely would like to see Rom on the big screen. And this is the version I'd really like, is the Marvel version, but hell, I'd even settle for the IDW one, because that one was pretty cool too. But anyway, when I saw that you had chosen Rom, I got really excited. But then when I saw it was this issue, I was kind of like, eh, because I don't like the comic book version of the X-Men. And I didn't remember this story being very good. I'm wrong, because rereading it, I actually do like it. I think it's pretty good. I do think the art suffers a bit in this one. And I hate saying that, because I came to really appreciate Sal Buscema on this series. And I think it's finally just time for me to outright admit I like Al Milgrom. I really do. I like his art. I think it's sentiment talking, because he was working on Spider-Man when I really got into Spider-Man. So I think there's a lot of sentimentality there. Unfortunately, I get the feeling just by the credits on this that this was a rush job, and it feels like a rush job, unfortunately. The art is not up to the same caliber as other issues of Rom from this from this same time. It's not horrible. It's just I know that there's better out there by Buscema, and I can't remember who his regular inker is. I can't remember if it was Milgrom or not. That said, I mean, yeah, it's the X-Men, and I'm not crazy about the X-Men, but for the most part, they're used to pretty good effect. And I think you have to remember that this is kind of, what do you call it? Like proto nascent uncanny X-Men, because they hadn't been around real long when, during this time, at least I don't think so. I mean, if Sprite's here, they've not been around long enough for Wolverine to become like Wolverine as we think of him, because he's a little out of character here based on what we know him to eventually be. At least I think so.
Well, this would be around when the X-Men was in the 140s.
Okay.
You know,
that's still pretty early, right?
After the Phoenix Saga, but before there were like 80 X-Men books on the stand at once.
Right. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. I found Wolverine to be, just kind of still that earlier version of Wolverine, where they hadn't quite nailed down his personality yet and all, his different ticks and everything. But of course, this is well before, the Frank Miller miniseries and that sort of thing too, which made him a ninja or samurai or whatever the hell, all that stuff. This is, might still even be that period where, he was supposed to be more of like a cyborg or something like that. I don't know. That was just the feeling I got from him, is like his personality hadn't quite gelled yet. But a couple of things I really liked about this, I like, even though I wish it was depicted a little bit better, I do get the impression that Wolverine was able to carve up Rom a little bit, mm-hmm. and that was kind of interesting. I wish they had shown more of that, but clearly he hurt him, and I thought that was kind of interesting, because, up to this point, you're not sure what Rom could withstand. I mean, here's a guy who, I think some of the earlier issues said that he was, able to, fly the space waves and could fly through a sun and all this sort of thing. And, so it was that question of, what was he susceptible to? But it does look like Wolverine takes a chunk out of him at one point. And then I really liked when, Kitty Pryde was known as Sprite at this time. I liked when she phased through him, because that was one of the things with her early, the early version of her powers, is that, if she phased through like a computer in the danger room or something, it would make the computers go all screwy and that sort of thing. And, so much of Rom is machinery. He's a cyborg. He's mostly machine. So I like that hurt him and affected his systems and all that sort of thing. Really, my big thing with this, though, And I don't know that this really occurred to me the first time, you know, reading the whole series and reading this issue, but it definitely occurred to me this time. One of the things that does bother me about this, though, and I think this does happen elsewhere in this, you know, later in the series as well, but up to this point, as I recall, the Dire Wraiths, you know, Rom's whole deal is that, you know, he's come to Earth because that's his basically his mission in life is to destroy the Dire Wraiths, and they are evil personified. You know, they have no redeeming qualities. They are just pure evil. So his mission is to banish them all to basically to hell. You know, that's what he does with his neutralizer. You know, he sends them to limbo. So that's his whole reason for being. But with this issue, you know, we learn that there was a wraith that gave up, you know, basically turned to the good side. You know, he gave up his evil wraith-like ways, settled down with an earth woman, and raised a child. And I'm thinking, doesn't that now add an element to Rom that now you've called his whole mission into question? Like, he had this, you know, this ironclad resolve that he was good, they were bad, it's purely black and white. Now you've introduced an element of gray into this story, and I don't know that I really like that. I don't know that now Rom seems as clear-cut as he did before, because now it shows that, well, no, they're not all evil to the core. They're not all pure evil. You've got at least this one that was able to give up his evil ways and become a loving father. So what does that say about our hero now? You know what I mean? And it, I don't know, because I like to think of Rom as the way that Mantlo tried to depict him, as he is a pure light being, you know, like he is the righteous hero in this story. And in this one, I'm not so sure that that's the case going forward. I don't know. What do you guys think of that?
I think that creates an interesting dilemma. And I do like that. But yeah, it does. It makes it so that he should have to think before he blast people into limbo, or blast wraiths into limbo, to kind of see, you know, what side of the fence they're on. And that may not be, you know, that may almost make the stories too complicated to go forward, and that's the problem. But it's a cool dilemma. One of the things I forgot to mention, though, that disturbed me in this reading of it, even though I don't recall the, you know, first time I read it ever having even thought about it. Wolverine saying, you know, I smell evil. Well, what exactly does evil smell like?
Oh, you'll know evil when you smell it.
You know, it
smells like ass, doesn't it?
Like ass.
It's like you're at a Comic-Con.
It smells like con funk.
But yeah, you know, I do agree, and I hadn't really even thought about it until you brought it up about the dilemma now that you have an upstanding Dire Wraith. How are you gonna, you know, justify your actions of just blasting the, you know, blasting and asking questions later? So I agree. It's interesting. I kind of wish, and I don't think they did, but I kind of wish they had made that into a dilemma for him.
You know, it's an unfortunate side effect of I don't know, my age, my shitty memory, whatever. You know, I just read this series within the past, you know, 5-6 years, and now already I can't remember. But I do think this comes up again now that I really think about it, and I could be wrong. Hopefully there's a listener out there that, you know, that's familiar enough with this to correct me. But I do think this comes up again, because I think there's something tickling my brain that says that there's a scenario that comes up where Rom spares a wraith, I think, that he was intent to blast, you know, and either kill or send to limbo. I forget, because I'm trying to remember if he ever actually killed Wraiths.
He sent them to Limbo. In this one instance, because he wasn't able to send this one to Limbo, he was going to actually kill him.
I think the gimmick and the reason why at this point he's hunted in the beginning of the series is that to human eyes, when he neutralizes a Wraith in human form, it looks like he kills them because their body, the body they've assumed, disintegrates, but then the whatever, the soul, the invisible part that's actually the Wraith, then goes to Limbo. But Rom's the only one that sees them going to Limbo. To humanize, it looks like he just murdered them.
Yeah, because they leave like a like ashes or something when he does
it. Yeah, and that's why he's hunted and, you know, a man, you know, a robot on the run in the beginning of the series and everything.
I think there was that one Wraith who wrote on the rock, "No kill eye."
See, I can't even, like I say, it's, you know, I just read this a few years ago and now already, you know, it's fading in my memory. I'm with you, Paul. I want to reread this now just to find out, how does he get out of Limbo?
I seem to remember him somehow meeting up with the Space Phantom, and that maybe is how he gets out.
Yes. Now that you say that rings a bell. Yes.
Which is why this series is so mingled into the Marvel Universe lore that I love that.
Yeah. Yeah, he crossed paths with, you know, a number of characters through the Marvel Universe. There was Power Man and Iron Fist.
Shang-Chi.
Shang-Chi, yeah.
Galactus.
I don't remember that. I don't remember Galactus.
Yes. I think he even briefly becomes a Herald.
Oh, did he? Oh, I don't remember that.
I seem to remember that.
I was going to say Nova, but I can't remember. Was Nova in it, or was it just the torpedo from Nova? Because I know the torpedo's in there at some point, but did he meet Nova as well?
Not that I can remember.
He battles the Gladiator at one point.
I don't remember that either.
Which wasn't bad. Yeah, it was in one of the annuals. The annual has, that particular annual has like a beautiful cover. I think it's Bob Layton. Unfortunately, the interior art was kind of shit, but the story was still really good, you know, of him going up against...
I have this entire series, and I have 3 out of 4 of the annuals. I'm missing...
Which one are you missing?
I'm missing the one with Gladiator.
Oh, yeah, I think that's number 4,
yeah,
I think.
That's the one I'm missing.
3 or 4.
I'll find it eventually in a discount plan somewhere.
I'll keep an eye out for you. Yeah, I still continue to see... issues, including number 1, which is odd to me because I know that recently they did a facsimile edition, mm-hmm. I think.
Dave needs issue number 1, and then every issue after that.
There you go.
I have this on my to read list from the.
I was just going to ask you if you had any interest because I think you'd dig this. I really do. I think you'd enjoy it quite a bit.
I have copies.
There you go. It's good. I mean, I've got so much other stuff I need to be getting to that I, you know, things I've collected, things I've spent good money on, and see, you know, sitting in a box rotting unread. But at some point, I need to make the time to reread this because it's like I say, it's already fading from my memory. But I do know that I enjoyed the hell out of it. I was so happy to finally own the whole series, but then also sitting down and reading it, because while they are two completely different series, it gave me a lot of the same feeling and vibe and just good feelings as like reading Marvel Star Wars back in the day. It just took me back to that kind of feeling, you know?
Well, this is clearly something you're going to get a lot more out of if you read it all, as opposed to just picking and choosing.
Yeah, yes, I agree. And in that respect, it's similar probably to the G.I. Joe issue.
Yeah. Because it does, it, you know, it builds on itself. You know, it starts with a really good premise. It builds on itself. Rom is just, Rom, in to my opinion, you know, he's just a wonderful character because he's very He's very straightforward for one. He has a very simple mission. You know, he's here to protect humanity from this threat, which, as the series starts, he's the only one that's aware of it. He's the only one that can see it and detect it and deal with it, you know, to his own detriment, because it makes him look like a murderer to everybody else. But, you know, he gets a really good cast of supporting characters, and the story goes in really good places. But he's a very noble character. And I like that about him. You know, he has a certain demeanor and a certain nobility, and he's likable. Like in this, you know, I mean, I think in some ways he could easily overpower and defeat the X-Men, but he knows that they're good guys. So he doesn't want to just wipe them out or you know, kick their asses or whatever. He's trying to, you know, do the right thing. And not hurt them or anything like that, but at the same time, you know, defend himself because they think he's the bad guy type of thing. And I like that. Makes it interesting because it gives him that much more of a hurdle to overcome. And there's a lot of that in the early issues of this series where, you know, he's kind of getting battered around and stuff. Because of the misunderstanding, you know, while he's having to hold back for fear of, you know, harming other people, even though, you know, he's in the right and they're in the wrong. But, you know, just that whole dynamic. I like that. I think there's something cool about that.
Agreed.
I'm looking forward to reading this.
You'll report back to us once you have your information.
Yes, I shall do that.
In the meanwhile, I guess we can rate this.
Sure.
I think this cover, as I mentioned earlier, is extremely dynamic and well-drawn, well-laid-out. I'm going to say a solid A on the cover. The interior art, unfortunately, I believe, suffers from mediocre inking. Again, I think Sal Buscema's layouts are fine, but he requires a strong hand as an inker in order to really make his artwork excel. And I don't feel like he got it in this issue. So layouts, excellent. Final product, B-. The story, again, I kind of had to pull myself back a little bit because I was looking for this to be a true team-up issue. And it really isn't. It's really a ROM story, and the X-Men happen to be in it. You know, they have a significant role in it, but they are not co-stars. It's, at least from my perspective, they aren't given the same motivational thought process. They aren't given the depth. But when I look at it from that perspective, I think this was a pretty engrossing story with a very threatening villain. And I really enjoyed it. So I'm gonna say a solid B plus on the story. And overall I'm gonna give this book a B plus.
Cool. I'll go next. The cover is a solid A minus for me. It's exciting, it's got a lot of action, it's something that would definitely pull you in to buy. The interior art, I thought it was pretty good. I gave the interior art a solid B plus. I like the layouts. Overall, the coloring's great. I enjoyed it. The story, it's because of me. It's not you, it's me.
I invented it's not you, it's me.
I could only give the story a B minus, and it's because it's on me. It's not on the story itself. I needed more background to get more out of this. But you know, it's an exciting tale. I don't want to take anything away from it. But I think if I had read the previous issues, I would have gotten out a lot more from it, and my grade would be a lot higher.
I really like this cover, and it's funny because I'm really not much for Frank Miller, but when I see good stuff by him, I can appreciate it. I've always thought he was a good layout guy. I just don't generally like his finished art, but I think he is well matched and very shorn up by Terry Austin here, who's an incredible artist and inker in his own right. And I think this is a very dynamic cover. I really, really like it. So I'm going to go a straight up A on the cover. I think this is really cool. Interior art, I'm shocked that I'm going to be the harshest one on the interior art, because, as I say, I really like Al Milgrom. It's just this isn't his best stuff. And I think also it really does reek to me of being a rush job, just with so many hands in this project. I don't want to be harsh on Sal Buscema either, but I this isn't his best stuff. I don't think it's entirely on the inkers. I think everybody's just rushed. I think there was probably some deadline doom things going on here. It's not horrible, but I know there's so much better in other issues of this series. So that said, I'm going to go a C+ on the art. I know there's a lot better out there, but it's not bad. I mean, it could be better. And then the story, I'm going to go straight up A on the story. I really, really dig this. I enjoyed it a lot. I think the only thing that holds it back from being an A+ for me is that, there's no like heart tug type of stuff here. It's a pretty straightforward. It's a fight. It's a battle. But I love that it has a great cliffhanger ending, and I'm always a sucker for a really good cliffhanger ending. And I don't care for Hybrid as a character. I just never did. But those are the only things holding it back from being a straight up A+ as far as the story goes. Otherwise, I think it's very well written, very well paced, very dynamic, and I like this setup of of Rom versus the X-Men, and I think it went down very well. And I like the depiction of the storm. I thought that was a really neat idea, that because of this raging blizzard, that things are indistinct and people can't hear what's being said. And I think that was depicted very well, both in the story and in the artwork. I thought that was kind of a neat and interesting way to play the whole battle. So yeah, this is a great issue. I think as an overall grade, the art notwithstanding, I think I will give the overall book a straight up, I'll say a B- as an overall grade. I enjoy this a lot.
I like.
And again,
I'm sorry.
I was just gonna say, if you haven't read it, or you like Rom but you have kind of a spotty collection, whatever the case may be, seek these out, man. I'm telling you, you can still collect the whole series out of the cheap bins, and it's well worth your time. It's a damn good read.
You mentioned about the storm, and I like the fact that it was actually Hybrid manipulating Storm's powers without her even being aware of it. I thought that was a very cool description of what was going on. So
yeah.
So that was our All Toys episode. We hope you had fun playing with us. And we'll catch you next week when we'll do something. I don't know.
I would like to hear from the listeners if you have other ideas of other toy-related books that we could have or should cover at some point. Let us know, because like I say, the Micronauts and the Superman toys are about the only things that really popped into my brain. I'd be very curious what else might be out there that we just didn't think of, or I just didn't think of, to maybe look at some point in the future.
Sure. All right, and that's it. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Yo, Joe.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.